The views expressed on The Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show. You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment, you are free to do so. Just send us an email so we know you're out there. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville, specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop. This week, Burse speaks with Greg Curry, a prisoner serving time for alleged participation in the Lucasville prison uprising of 1993, where prisoners took over the Ohio prison, leading to the death of 10 inmates and one guard. For the hour, they speak about incarceration in the U.S., intersections of race and class, the prison strikes, capitalism, and resistance. More on Greg's case can be found at gregcurry.org.
Happy birthday, Parks!
Here is another roundup of week two of the national prison strike. This information was pulled from Mask Magazine, It's Going Down, Support Prisoner Resistance, and the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. On September 12th, hunger strikes begin at Lucasville and Ohio State Penitentiary, called by the Free Ohio Movement. South Carolina prisoners release video of insects in their food. In Columbia, South Carolina, a confirmed strike at Broad River Correctional Institution. In Florida, more prisoner uprisings broke out on Monday night. According to the Miami Herald, quote, Florida state prisons have resumed normal operations despite a disturbance Monday night at Columbia Correctional, the fifth inmate uprising in less than a week, officials said. About 40 inmates engaged in civil disobedience by refusing officers' orders and taking control of at least one dorm Monday evening. In Columbia, one of the state's most violent prisons remained on lockdown on Tuesday. Since Thursday, inmates have caused trouble at four other prisons, all in the state's panhandle, including Gulf Annex Correctional, Mayo Correctional, and Jackson Correctional. The most serious melee was at Holmes Correctional, where 400 inmates destroyed several dorms on Thursday. Inmates involved in any incident have been moved to other prisons. End quote. On September 13th, Chelsea Manning ends her hunger strike that she began on September 9th. The Army has agreed to grant her demands of gender-affirming surgery. On September 14th, Support Prisoner Resistance reports prison lockdowns in Arizona. Perryville, Yuma, Tucson, Douglas, and Phoenix participated, though it is unclear whether these are related to the strike. More information is forthcoming. On September 16th, in Merced, California, supporters report another block joins a hunger strike. You can hear full coverage of this situation on the most recent IGDcast at itsgoingdown.org. On September 17th, in Holman Prison in Alabama, the Free Alabama Movement issues a press release calling for an end to the humanitarian crisis at the prison. They state through social media that many guards are not reporting to work and that much of the prison remains unguarded. This is from a press release which came out yesterday. Quote, a serious humanitarian crisis is developing at Holman Prison as correctional officers continue to walk off the job amid concerns about safety and apathy from Warden Terry Rabin and the Office of ADOC Commissioner Jefferson S. Dunn, as violence, including deadly stabbings and assaults, continues to mount. Several officers expressed dismay and fear after learning that two of their fellow officers, Officer Brian Easel and another officer, reported to Warden Rabin that they had knives drawn on them and that their lives threatened, and that neither Warden Rabin nor Commissioners Jeff Dunn and Grant Culliver would take any action to ensure their safety. Both of these officers then quit. Several other officers have also quit in the past 3 weeks after witnessing a stabbing of a fellow officer in the temple and who had remained hospitalized with life-threatening injuries until he was pronounced dead earlier today. This after a former warden, Carter Davenport, was stabbed in March amidst back-to-back riots and other violence at Pullman. Now, after seeing Warden Rabin released approximately 20 people from segregation on September 13, 2016, most of whom were all in segregation for violent incidences, only to see several stabbings take place, including one critically injured and another losing an eye, a total of 8 more officers have either quit or turned in their 2 weeks' notice. Officers are expressing concern that the commissioners of the ADOC are intentionally exacerbating violence at the expense of human life in efforts to push forward their plan to extort the public for $1.5 billion to build new prisons in the next year's legislative session. Officers have begun to express support for the nonviolent stance of the Free Alabama movement and their efforts to expose corruption, violence, and other issues plaguing Holman and other Alabama prisons, and have gone so far as to make repeated requests to Warden Rabin for the release of FAM co-founder and organizer Kinetic Justice from solitary confinement, because officers now feel that he is being wrongfully detained and because he has repeatedly demonstrated the ability to conduct peaceful demonstrations at Holman Prison to bring attention to issues within the ADOC and Holman Prison. We are asking that everyone call Commissioner Dunn and Warden Rabin and demand that they post daily reports of the staffing levels and incidents of violence taking place at Holman as a matter of public safety. He can be reached at Warden Terry Rabin, Holman Correctional Facility, area code 251-386-8173, and Commissioner Jefferson Dunn and Commissioner Grant Culliver can be found at area code 334-353-3883. We're going to close this roundup with this update from inside prison walls in South Carolina. Quote, "Comrades up here are having an inside meeting to critically analyze the prison strike's strong and weak positions. For many, it didn't go far enough. Crucial points of resolution were not addressed. Certain regions didn't feel the love, so the fire didn't burn where they were at. Strong points. It was time. Unity was found on the outside. More people are talking about prison issues. Inside prisoners found unity in certain units or prisons. We too are talking more. These are just samples of what we need to start discussions around, particularly the prisoners. Because this will tell us how to add this moment in the movement to the collective of prison rebellions to strengthen it and toss the weak points. Big ups to the prisoners that are always refusing to comply. I'm one. For over a decade, I've been punished with little privileges due to my insistent stance not to work. So the prisons close us off from the working prisoners. It's good to see others joining, but it's not enough. They'll let the few of us lay. So to be truly effective, time to plan and prepare for the next phase." End quote. Meanwhile, the IWOC is making every effort to track the strike in hopes of continuing this resistance and locating forms of solidarity and calls for assistance. If you would like to help this effort, there is a comprehensive phone zaps list that includes a rundown of phone numbers, some context for the specific struggle, and suggested scripts to read if and when you do get the pigs on the line. This is in Google Docs format, so it would be pretty ridiculous to read it out here, so we are going to link it in our blog post at ashevillefm.org/the-final-straw and at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. Also, if you hear anything or are able to call prisons and ask about lockdown status, please let the IWOC know via email at iwoc@riseup.net. And if you make calls for a given state and hear of no lockdowns, please report that too. Stay tuned all around for updates on the strike. Much love and solidarity. And finally, though not lastly, just to plug and to yet again express our love for our jailed North Carolina and Georgia comrades, people here in Asheville and in Atlanta still need donations for legal funds. All of these folks were arrested while expressing solidarity with the prison strike, and the folks from Atlanta are facing some insane felony charges. All of them are out of jail now, but are beginning the long, slow battle with the criminal injustice system, and they need your support. to donate to comrades in Asheville and to see a pretty sweet write-up of the events of the day in our town, you can visit actionnetwork.org/fundraising/legal-support-4-WNC-September-9-solidarity-activists. And to express solidarity to Atlanta, you can visit actionnetwork.org/fundraising/bail-out-prison-strike-supporters.
I'd like to share a few notes on recent anarchist audio and video media in English that I've been appreciating in hopes of enticing you, dear audience, into checking them out. Crime Thinks the Ex-Worker has begun rebroadcasting. The most recent episodes of the podcast focus on the September 9th strike with a conversation with Azura of the ABC in Austin, Texas, and Ben Turk of IWOC in Wisconsin. Episode 49 also includes a review of Captive Nation, Black Organizing in the Civil Rights Era, an interview with an anarchist in the UK about Brexit, and other tidbits. Number 50 also includes a segment mourning the death of Jordan McTaggart, an American anarchist who died on the front lines in Rojava recently, a segment celebrating the death of former police chief and all-around King Bastard, John Timoney, and a rebroadcast of a Chernolucnia interview with members of DAF about Turkey after the attempted coup. These ex-workers are well worth a listen and available at crimethink.com/podcast. Also, Submedia's most recent episodes on strikes, the DAPL pipeline, and more, entitled Burn Down the Plantation, features a great interview with Melvin Ray of the Free Alabama Movement. This sits alongside a second video installment explaining anarchist fundamentals, this time featuring the concept of mutual aid, short videos on continued struggles in France against the Loi Travail, direct action against fascists in Athens, and more, and can be found at submedia.tv/stimulator. It's Going Down is now producing the IDG cast, which can be found at itsgoingdown.org. Timely interviews on the uprising in Milwaukee, words from the Red Warrior camp at Standing Rock against the Dakota Access Pipeline, the state of the alt-right or new white nationalist movements in North America, and a discussion on communes and struggle with Morgan and Elirante. The most recent episode features an interview with a woman on hunger strike in Merced, California, in solidarity with hunger-striking prisoners against the deplorable situation in this poor and rural county's jails. The jails have witnessed abuses, deaths, and injuries among those imprisoned in adult and juvenile detention at the hands of sadistic COs. Find the latest IDG cast at itsgoingdown.org/podcast. Resonance Audio Distro, or RAD, is a source for radical and anarchist audio of zines, books, and essays, among other things, and has produced an awesome and lengthy interview with Sylvie Kashtan and Robbie Barnes to give context to two plays by these rapscallions that Resonance put online. Robbie and Sylvie are longtime anarchists living in the Seattle area who have been involved in the Fifth Estate magazine for decades and have tons of stories and experience to share. Check out Resonance at resonanceaudiodistro.org. Season 2 of The Brilliant Podcast has begun and is apparently headed towards a new format. The most recent episode features a conversation with Isaac Cronin, curator of Cruel Hospice imprint at Little Black Cart, and he talks about his experiences of situationism, pro and post-situ ideas, and play in the U.S. since the 1960s. Check this and more out at thebrilliant.org. Finally, hip-hop artist Soul, S-O-L-E, is continuing to put out interesting discussions on his podcast, Soulcast. Most recently, Soul talked with Franco Bifo Berardi on capitalism, mass killing, suicide, and alienation. Episodes can be found at soul1.org/soulcast, and Soul in this context is S-O-L-E. More suggestions on media to come in the near future.
And now for some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? Record like a bomb! I'm officially a terrorist now, according to the state of Ohio, the rogue state holding me hostage. I received the conduct report that stems from the Nazis seizing the handwritten script of one of my radio segments and it actually contains the word terrorist. Let me read to you what the Nazis wrote. Check this out. On September 8th at approximately 12:30 p.m., Officer Spencer conducted a search of inmate Swain, 243205. During the search, some documents were retrieved. One of them was a letter which included language that indicates possible terrorist-type activities. One of the paragraphs talks about an organized effort of inmates to have a work stoppage, but the writer, inmate Swain, says that he is not endorsing it. Other paragraphs talk about specific ways to disrupt correctional operations, but the writer, inmate Swain, writes that he is saying to do it. The material is telling the readers how to conduct these activities in detail. However, he makes sure to add that he is not saying to actually do it, as to cover his liability and to get the message across at the same time. There was also a self-authored booklet confiscated, which includes anti-government material. Yep, I'm now officially a terrorist, folks. The Nazis said so. But don't forget, my language that indicates possible terrorist-type activities, whatever in the hell that means, was recorded for the final straw. And the final straw is broadcast on airwaves regulated by the Federal Communications Commission. The show is broadcast from a real radio station with electricity and equipment and a powerful antenna. A radio station with corporate sponsors who sell breakfast pastries and beer and tampons. Then, as I understand it, the show gets rebroadcast from other real radio stations all over the world, all with their own corporate sponsors. So think about this. If my radio segment really promoted terrorism, that involves a complicated international terrorist conspiracy. First, the final straw would have to be down with terrorism since it broadcasts my incoherent nonsense. Second, the radio station would have to be down with terrorism too. And third, as an extension of the radio station being down with terrorism, that means the continuing corporate sponsors selling pastries and beer and tampons are knowingly supporting terrorism. But fourth, it also means that the FCC, an agency of the federal government, is rubber-stamping my terrorism with their inaction. That's quite a terrorist conspiracy that Warren Corruptional's oblivious cage worshippers have managed to uncover. The entire sprawling, capitalist corporate megastructure is continuing to fund my terrorist messaging, and the FCC is facilitating it. Wow, we're bigger than ISIS. But it's even deeper than that. Since the conduct report was written, containing the word terrorist, I've spent the better part of a week in population at a level 3 prison. I strolled all over the compound conversing with prisoners on a regular basis, meeting with folks at the library, possibly spreading my terrorist plots. And it hasn't so much as occurred to anyone that someone like me, a terrorist, should perhaps be segregated or even shipped off to the Super Duper Max. You know, the prison where my involvement in the radio show began. This is inexplicable to me. My best guess is that Warden Shay Harris must be part of my terrorist network. Somebody needs to contact the FBI right away. This hapless clown is facilitating my terrorism, right along with the FCC, corporate America, and the famous dead guy who invented the radio. Warren Corruptional Security Threat Group investigators are going to have to dig him up and interrogate him. Not Shay Harris, the guy who invented the radio. But you know who else is involved in this terrorist conspiracy? Lieutenant Kevin Chamberlain, who wrote the conduct report. Yesterday I handed him material from my cell that is both anti-government and supports what he's called terrorism. I told him I'd get even more stuff together so he could write 25 more conduct reports. After all, we can't have a terrorist like me running around at a level 3 prison, right? He declined. He refused to write 25 more conduct reports. I guess the ISIS High Command must have turned him or something. The warden, the FCC, corporate America, Alexander Graham Bell, and now even Lieutenant Kevin Chamberlain are part of my terrorist conspiracy. And if Lieutenant Nelson, the chair of the Rules Infraction Board, doesn't send me straight to the Super Duper Max, we can only assume he's secretly involved in this terrorist conspiracy too. Wow. Whoever investigates all of this sure is going to really need a big detective bag. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional in Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you're probably a terrorist too. Shake your rope.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren, CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
Can you introduce yourself and tell folks about your case a little bit?
Yes, my name is Greg Curry. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. I've been in prison since 1989. I was sent down to a prison called Lucasville. It's down in southern Ohio, and I happened to be there when this major prison riot happened in 1993, and as a result of that, I got charged and convicted of some of the more serious crimes out of it. Now, that's pretty much my story in a nutshell.
And you've been recently involved in, or at least paying attention to, the calls for ending prison slavery organizing. Can you talk about your views on that?
Totally support it. You know, each state that's involved has its own unique issues that's unique to its state or its prison system. So I support and respect it all. And here I've asked a few people to support it because here at this prison it's only like one porter per 16 people, and it's 16 people in each pod. And so it's one porter per. So, you know, the people that I know, I've asked them to support it, or at least gave them information on why they should support it so that they can make an informed decision on their own. And it just in general, I support things that I believe that will help oppressed people get the foot off their neck.
What are conditions like in your pod, in the facility that you're in terms of labor and in terms of access to programs and recidivism and stuff?
Yeah, well, as long as federal grants and state grants is around, then they will find a program to hire one of their friends, retired teachers, counselors, or whatever, and they'll run these programs through here. But basically, because of the lack of movement in this high-security prison, people use the service to get out of their cell so they can see people from other pods that they wouldn't normally see and talk to them and, you know, associate or whatever. So that's why I said to start the interview is that each state has its own unique issues. And this for this prison in this state, the lack of movement means people are looking for ways to move around. So they use programs and religious services. You may have a guy that's signed up for Islamic, Christian, and Catholic service and go to all of them that week just so he could be out of the cell and mix with people from other areas of the prison. So that's what the services amount to, basically. As far as work, like I said, it's 16 people per pod, one porter per pod. And he just cleaned the two showers and sweeped the rain. So it's not much. It's not working in laundries and the chow hall and stuff like that. This is high. Supposed to be a supermax prison, so you don't have that here. Pretty much all of the services are brought to our cells.
Just off the top of my head, what sorts of words would you want to get out to folks who are on the outside? Like, this show airs in Columbus, Ohio, so there are folks in your home state who are going to hear this over the radio. What kind of words do you have to say about the prison strike, what your experience on the inside is, and what sort of changes this could bring to your situation?
That's a pretty big question there, but I would like to say to the people that are supporting us, you know, I respect that you have a multitude of things that you could do with your day, and yet you share some portion of it with us. Some of us you've never met before, you maybe only heard of or read about our case. So, you know, I really respect and appreciate that support. And I would like to encourage everybody to keep on going and keep inviting others in and keep fighting for us and fighting with us. And those are two different things. I really believe that the people that are fighting for us should know some of us in here so you can know exactly what you it is you're fighting for. You know, not just the ideal of shutting prisons down or justice in the prison system, but know the people that you're fighting for, what their needs are. And I think the movement can grow and have a lot more energy to it if you could take those stories that you learn about from dealing with prisoners on a personal level and then just move it to the streets, take that energy to the struggle in the streets.
With your specific case, do you have any forward motion? Are you appealing or do you have any appeals left?
Yeah, well it's hard for me to get in court because I wasn't put on death row, so my appeal options are very limited, and those that I have, I can't burn them without having a really strong argument first. I'm gathering a lot of different parts of evidence to attack this all at once, and I'm close to filing a court action here soon. And we just can't burn it up like that, because if we use it and we don't have everything right, then they just say, okay, you exhausted that and you can't come back again. So I have to be all the way right. And I have a law school that's right now looking at it, considering whether they want to take and represent the case to the court too. So I'm hopeful that will be a positive sign. But you can check out the evidence in my case at gregcurry.org or lucasvilleamnesty.org, either of those sites, and it's full of official documents from the court. So you see just how they railroaded me and scratch your head along with me.
So I asked really generally, and you said that specifically people should get to know folks about folks by a case-to-case manner, folks that are incarcerated who have needs, who are participating in or may think about participating in the strikes. Do you have, even though you've got different circumstances state by state, do you have any words that you'd like to get out to other folks who are organizing or thinking about organizing around the work stoppages to end prison slavery as it exists in the United States?
Well, I think that the two goes together. The people on the street that's going to shout and scream and march for you and make the phone calls for you, along with the actions of the prisoners inside of the prison, the two go together, so I think they should be well coordinated. I think this effort here is well coordinated as best it could be, and I think that you must have that coordination and everybody on the same page so that it'll be smooth, because the state, whichever state we're talking about, going to make it hard as possible for you to succeed, and the media is going to make it look like you're not succeeding, you know. And by the way, kudos to the people in Oregon who shut the city down near, I think it was Friday or Saturday morning. I seen them on TV, and I was just so full of energy seeing them marching up and down the street with their banners and stopping the traffic and everything, you know. That was beautiful.
There were actions around the country and statements and banner drops and stuff at embassies around the world in support of the prisoners in the U.S.
Yeah, see, that's what I was saying a few seconds ago, though, that the media going to make it appear that it's nothing going on. And so, you know, in here, with my limited options to access to media, I was just able to see about the Oregon action there, nowhere else. I had no doubts that it was actions going on elsewhere. It was just that was the only one I was able to actually see on the regular TV, NBC. So,
for folks who are thinking of reaching out to prisoners they maybe don't know, do you think there's any danger in making contact with someone on the inside and then talking about the strike right away? Do you think that could put someone on a list or get them in trouble?
Well, no. I think that it shouldn't be too hard to find prisoners that's already struggling with the system and fighting the system, even in their limited environment and with limited options, that are already fighting. So I think that the people on the street trying to make that connection should look for those type of people and that's already established in struggle. And I think it will be an easier transition for them to move to a united struggle. And as far as maybe getting put on some kind of list or anything, well, it's always a chance of that. But I would say just be careful of the language you use. You know, I mean, you can pretty much say what you want. It's just a matter of how you say it. And I would also caution to be sure that you're involved with somebody that's truly involved, and so that you're not you find that one bad apple in prison and you had that bad experience and then the person on the street is turned off by it, and so I just hope that don't happen. Hopefully you can find someone that's truly involved, that truly believe in this struggle. And so even if it's tough times or hard times, you know you're in the trenches with someone that's in the trenches with you and got your back just as you have theirs.
That makes a lot of sense. Over the last few years, activists have renewed struggle around police killings on the streets of the U.S. In particular, the Black Lives Matter movement has focused on the statistically high rates of violence and deaths of black and brown people, men in particular, by police. Folks have raised a ruckus, have shared videos, have interrupted speeches and events, have shut down highways, conducted interviews, written articles, had conversations, occupied police departments. The list goes on. What have you seen of Black Lives Matter from the inside of your prison?
Well, I've heard a lot about Black Lives Matter and the movement because I follow current events, the news. I read a lot of non-mainstream material, newspapers and whatnot. So, yeah, I follow their story, the rise of them and all. And the climate is just right for their movement because it's just a movement of, I think it's a continuation of the Arab Spring, really, what was termed the Arab Spring a year and a half, 2 years ago. It was just people over there in the Middle East that was tired, sick of it, and decided to fight against it. And that sentiment has moved across the globe, and the Black Lives Matter people is feeling it. And when traditional civil rights people tried to step out in front of them and tell them how to do it or how not to do it or whatever, they wasn't having it. Get out of here. Get out of here with that. We going to do this our way. And, yeah, if something gets tore up, okay, so what? We going to keep going. And I was so proud of Black Lives Matter when after the Dallas protests happened and the police got killed, they could have easily have folded up and said, let's lay low for a while. But they were out for a just cause, the people that were dying, and they decided, no, we still need to do what we need to do because people are dying. So, yeah, I like what they're doing.
How does the struggle against white supremacy and against anti-blackness that BLM is involved in relate to the struggle against prisons?
Well, again, it's all the same. It's no different with the prison system or the oppression in the urban areas or the oppression over in the Middle East. Nowhere. It's all the same. People are tired of it and just ain't going to accept it the way they always have or the way the pastors and preachers across the country have told us, you know, just keep praying and things will get better. It's a new sentiment out there. This new generation is saying, no, we're not having it. We're not going to let a whole other generation pass by praying that things get better. We're going to confront this until it get better. And people in prison, as many of us, including myself, have come to prison with no awareness that we could truly speak of. And once we get locked down into solitary confinement with just books to read, we get lucky, really. And especially in my situation, I got lucky. I was put in solitary confinement for a conviction from this prison riot that happened here in 1993. And so happened, I had some, like, six dudes that was just conscious people that were all, they were reading in Population. And so they had all these books to share with me, but So when they passed me like 5 or 10 books, they was like, here, pick which one you want to read, you know, and just start reading, man, because you're going to be back here a while. And it was all, you know, Miseducation of a Negro, the Soledad Brothers, you know, stuff like this. And so it really wasn't my type of reading or what I thought I was about to receive. I was looking maybe more for some kind of entertainment. And these brothers thought more of me and sent me something along that level, and I had to pick up from that bunch. And once I read that first book, I never stopped. And so that consciousness awoke in me, because I had always seen the struggle. I had always lived the struggle. I just didn't know how to identify what I was going through. And these books helped clarify all that for me. And then the natural step after the clarification was to get involved. And so for the Black Lives Matter movement to be seeing this struggle on the street on a daily basis, where black folks and brown folks are getting killed, that awakes something in you. If you're human, it awakes something in you. And the next step is you have to do something. So in that regard, the prisoner of consciousness and the person on the street of consciousness is one and the same.
You're listening to an interview with Greg Curry, a prisoner serving time for alleged participation in the Lucasville Prison Uprising of 1993, where prisoners took over the Ohio prison, leading to the death of 10 inmates and one guard. More on Greg's case can be found at gregcurry.org.
I think about the fat men who wear their slippers to dry their clothes. The one that machines are running, they won't walk very far. They never realize what they've got, and one day they will lose a lot. Because of what's gonna happen when the buses don't run, and what's gonna happen when the winter comes. What are you gonna do? What are you gonna do when the oil runs out? About the record industry and the people it used, self-indulgent pampered pop stars, and which ones did you choose? It'll be far more drastic, but no more 12-inch plastic. Because of what's gonna happen when the buses don't run, and what's gonna happen when the winter comes. What are you gonna do? And what are you gonna do when the oil runs out? Are you prepared for such a drastic change in lifestyle? You say yeah, I don't believe you. And look at your home, the things that you own, the job that you work in, the hey, all could go. Who live in the sun? And when the
Well, you've got to admit that unless you're on the inside or have been, prisons are set up in such a way for people on the outside to not have to think about them except in fiction or in media that, quote, that's just the dark place where bad people go, unquote. What do you think it'll take to awaken folks on the outside who maybe don't realize what's going on in the belly of the beast?
Well, I'm glad to hear you at least say that, you know, because you're out there and you're touching people on a daily basis. So there's a start, you know. But, yeah, because you're so right that people are just like, okay, once we're picked up and put in that county jail system into the criminal justice system and it's over with, it's like we don't exist really no more or just exist in the abstract. And so... And as many layers of why that is too, not just the media portrayal of the criminal. I mean, people in the ghetto are living daily with the criminality, so and the violence of it, and so they see this, and to them, some people need to be put away and put away for a long time because they're bad people, and. Then you have a whole nother branch of people who can see that the suburbanites, they can see that, well, as more people that's put in prison from these undesirable areas, is more opportunities for us and our offspring. So that's self-preservation there for those kind of people. Then you have the areas where these prisons are built that had no jobs and no hope for the future. Everyone was thinking about leaving home to go find work somewhere else, and then here come this prison with not just the correctional officer jobs, but once that prison is put there, all of the fast food restaurants, the money lenders, the rental places, the cars, lots. Everything pops up, so now all of a sudden it's new life in this community, and so they don't want to see people let out of prison because they thinking like, well, what are we going to go back to if we don't have that cash cow sitting right up the street? So it's really a lot of competing issues, and it's for people like you to make the relationships with the people in prisons and try to bring that real life story to people. And I always say to people who, to the activists that try to help us in prison, get to know somebody personally, because when you talk to someone about me, they can tell how much you're into me, how much you know me, how deeply your heart is involved with me and this struggle. So it's really important for activists to not just have this distant relationship, but to really have a relationship that other people, that translate in your eyes when you talk to other people about the prison struggle. And then that, and if your experience is good with a prisoner, then that next person will say, well, hey, maybe I need to start writing prison. My brother, he is in there, or my uncle went to jail 10 years ago. I never wrote him. I wonder where he at. Let me check on him. Or, you know, when you tell the story about people being beat by these officers or starved to death or whatever, then maybe somebody will say, well, let me check on my cousin or my old boyfriend or my old girlfriend or whatever the case may be. I think that's just at least the beginning stages of how we make everybody aware that the prisoners do actually exist.
Another survivor and victim of the state of Ohio's prison system in relation to the Lucasville uprising, who's been vocal in support of the nonviolent prison strikes that started on September 9th, is Imam Sadiq Abdullah Hassan, formerly Carlos Sanders. Hassan is on death row for helping to end the Lucasville uprising with few deaths and has been an activist for quite a long time. He's also been on the final straw a few times. Currently, he's had his communications restricted and property denied him on charges that he tried to talk another imam into bringing an explosive into prison. Can you talk about Hassan and his silencing?
Yeah. Well, he's a good friend and a dear brother to me. While I was on that side, I'm on the opposite side of the prison from him now. For the last year or so, I've been on the opposite side of the prison. But we used to work out daily. We talk daily. And in fact, he wrote me last week, and I just answered his letter last night. So, yeah, he sent me his conduct report and everything. And the charges in itself is a joke. You charge somebody with terrorism, and you give them a phone restriction for terrorism. That just don't make sense, you know. So the charges are a joke. It just goes to show that even without the media exposure or the powers that be admitting, he's doing a good job with his organizing. If they knew he was doing a good job, and so they decided to derail him as best they could to slow the momentum down of this movement. But people just ain't having it. So you can't just take out this one guy or this one guy and think that this movement is going to stop. People are just not having it anymore. Yeah, earlier we had talked about my feelings on the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, and I'm always reluctant to, when people get out there and actually try to go to work for the good of people to criticize them or try to redirect or say what they should be doing. I hear that so much, that what they should be doing. But I think that for Black Lives Matter to really connect with the community and the prisoners' families, I think if they were performing community-related services, you know, sort of like what the Black Panther Party did, was to start up those kind of programs, health care or bus rides to the prisons or the breakfast program, which they're most famous for. But those kind of things is that bridge from the prison to the ghetto. And Black Lives Matter, I believe, will then be touching more people. To take an elder to the doctor or to the grocery store or cut their front line or whatever, some family member of a person in prison, I think that's the kind of community relationship that builds that bridge. So if anything, if I was able to give them any kind of advice, I would say they should look at that as just for the purpose of recruiting anyway.
And also it seems as if, as you've described, it's so hard to grow up under white supremacy and capitalism, doing for selves or community organizing in that way that's actually getting what you need to survive. You're making your life potentially easier as well as recruiting, a kind of dual purpose.
Right, exactly. You're doing everything that's right, and so people can't just ignore you. You know, a poor person needs a free bread basket, you know. So, just as people go into, and every day all over America, go into the Catholic Church's soup kitchens somewhere, and they may not believe in that religion or whatever, but they go in there to get that free bowl of soup, and they're going to hear something before they come out of there about the Catholic religion, or they're going to see something, you know, the cross of Jesus or Mary or something. So it's that kind of thing there, you know. As you said earlier in this interview, that it's almost as if prisoners don't exist, and it's so convenient for people to pretend like we don't exist, you know. But that bridge that I'm talking about, and not necessarily Black Lives Matter, but concerned citizens, you know, the prison activists, to create these services, to have a van that's running visitors, making it easy for poor families to go visit their family members, to keep that contact going. I think that builds momentum, and it keeps everybody connected. I really just believe that connection is key. That's where the energy comes from, all of us being able to feel each other's pulse.
So you've mentioned before, you were talking about people activating and sort of realizing, like, oh, I heard about this repression in this prison. I'm going to reach out to an ex-partner or a family member or a friend who got put into the system at one point and see how they're doing. A lot of studies that I've read have made a direct connection between how difficult it is and being made more so every day for prisoners and their families, who particularly are poor, to keep their direct connections. I mean, this parallel between a lack of connection and recidivism. Can you talk about this?
Yeah. What the visitation is now is the harder part, because there's been so much scrutiny on these phone companies, these phone monopolies in prisons, that here in Ohio and most other states that I've read about, the prices have come down on the phone. So the phone call itself is reasonable. But again, because people are poor from the outset, they're poor. So their struggle is just to put food on the table for them and their kids. And maybe their brother, or maybe the father of their kids is in prison, or maybe their son is in prison. But because they need to eat, you know, it's hard to spare a dollar for the person in prison. And the media does such a good job of saying that prisoners are sitting up in jail getting fat, watching cable TV and this, that, and the other. And so people on the street say, okay, well, the state will take care of me. You know, they got them. They'll take care of them. I need to do this or that or the other. So, again, but it's that disconnect there. And of course, capitalism is the ultimate problem. All of the other issues are just symptoms of capitalism.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
But capitalism is definitely the problem. Now, and the people, some of us have come to jail and have done our families wrong, whether it's before we was fully mature or not. We have done our families wrong. We have done our communities wrong. And so, on some level, those people are glad to see you not dead, but away from them. So a lot of people in prison have that problem where their mothers never check up on them. I'm fortunate that my mother and father, my father recently passed away, but both of them were always in my life.
I'm sorry for your loss.
All right, thanks. But they're not. They were poor people, so it wasn't much they could do. My father, he came to visit. He died of cancer, and he came to visit me just a month or so before, and he cried on the visit. This big strong man in my life, he cried on the visit in front of me, and he said, "Man, I don't think I'm gonna be able to see you get out of jail, and I wasn't able to get you out of jail." That you know, that hurt him. It hurt his pride. It hurt him as a man that he had to leave his son behind enemy lines like this, and he knew he was leaving this world, and he couldn't do nothing about it. So for me personally, I never violated my family, but many of these guys here have violated or disrespected their parents so much that they don't want that connection. But for those that haven't burnt that bridge, poverty is usually the issue that can't get the visit there. The phone call, most people can use the phone now, but the visits are more problematic.
And I've been hearing that a lot of states have been cutting back on person-to-person visits, which can be difficult to get time off for and pay for transit to, and exchanging that for video visits that cost money.
I don't think it's really true that most states are doing it. I think what's more true is that the states are being bought off by these companies with monopolies on this kind of technology so that they can sell these visits and make a profit. I think that's more accurate. That is what's happening in these states. They do video visits here in this state, but they also still allow for regular visits, but it's no telling when that's going to stop. But what I was saying was that as a person who went 13 and a half years of no contact with no human beings at all, all my business was in the glass booths they have here. I know that human contact is important. There's no reason at all for them to take that away, other than being just money hungry and inhumane. That's the only reason. I want 13 and a half years, man, with no contact with no one. And it's a terrible thing. And then I had where I had 2 years where I, after that I got contact with my mom's. I got to hug her for 2 years on visits, and then the last 6 years I wasn't allowed to. So I know firsthand that contact, and especially when the mass majority of prisoners are going home, you need to keep them human. And you sit a person around and you treat them like animals, and you don't let them have contact, and you don't let them have a normal life or lifestyle, or as normal as possible in the prison setting. You're setting them up to fail, and their failure is going to be harmful to society. They releasing people from this prison that's supposed to be a supermax prison and they haven't had no contact with anyone for years, and all of a sudden they're out there in the middle of downtown at rush hour. Yeah, and it's a crazy experience. Everything's moving too fast for a person that's released from solitary confinement, but they're doing it every day in every state, releasing people from solitary confinement. It's crazy.
Yeah, it seems like if the role is rehabilitation, that it would relate to actually making people functional within society and allowing them to rebuild the skills of having relationships with people.
Oh, right, and which rebuilding the skills with people to relate to people, but also giving them more responsibility in their life. And that's in the prison setting. Maybe the wardens or whoever are afraid to allow people to have too much control of their own life, even in a prison setting. You know? But I guess you got to keep these beds filled, because these are jobs. People depend on these jobs, so you need these beds filled. As I said to you earlier, this prison gives you a free TV upon arrival. Flat screen color TV. I've never even owned a flat screen color TV myself, but they give them away soon as somebody arrives here. So it's incentive for someone to come to a solitary confinement jail.
So we're talking about the relationship between capitalism and incarceration and the jobs that it supposedly brings to communities and filling beds. And I think it should frighten people on the outside that profit motive is being sought in incarcerating people. That the government, when it's wielding its baton, is giving the opportunity for private businesses more and more to take over the services related to incarceration and make money off of that. Can you talk about, in the time that you've been inside, services, seeing services go into private hands and what sort of effect that's had on food quality or access to programs or visitation and phone services?
And that's a good subject too, and I think it's a subject that needs more attention. I know that the Koch brothers and Van Jones, who was pretty progressive, are teaming up with some of the politicians to deal with some of this stuff too that you just mentioned. But yeah, since I came to prison, we used to could get a food box sent from home. Our parents could go to the local grocery store and, you know, purchase items that they know we like and ship them to us in the box. We used to get our clothes from the street, you know, tennis shoes, underwear, socks, whatever. And along came a couple companies, Access and a few others. I can't think of their name right now. But they bought contracts from the state, or got awarded contracts from the state, and now they control all of that. We can't get anything sent from home, so it all comes from these private companies. They say it's for security purposes, but they get to put this cartel on what we can buy, what kind of items we can buy, and just make all of this money across the whole state, and it's all theirs. When I first came to prison, our families would send a money order right to the prison and the cashier's office was in the prison. Each prison had a cashier's office. They would cash the check, take it to the bank, put it in the bank, put the money on our books so we could spend it. J-Pay bought into that and told them they'd handle all of our money for us. So, you know, all of this food service maybe 5 years ago went to a company called Aramac, who was having problems all over the United States with maggots in their food, the quality of it, the quantity of it. And they bought the, they got somehow was awarded the contract, and so now they run all of the food service. It just, everything is just going private for profit, for profit, for profit, everything. I would imagine one of these days soon they're going to charge us for water, how many cups of water we get a day.
Can you talk about medical services in your facility and what it costs to visit the doctor and any medications and such?
The medical, this many years ago, they started charging what they call a copay, which is $2 to $3 per visit. Well, not per visit. If you need to initiate services, it's $2 to $3. And then you have to go through this process of convincing the doctors that you are sick and need, you know, a medication on, and now they've, because of all the opiate abuse on the street, they have cut it back in the prisons too. And so now people who have these back pains and long lingering pain, most of us have been shot or something from our rough days on the street. So we go out there for pain, and instead of sending us, like myself, I've asked to go get my problems fixed. I don't want to be on medication. So then they have to email someone in Columbus who has never done any screening on us or anything and ask them, well, can we send this person to Columbus for examination? And that person gets to decide if the problem is serious enough. And usually they say, no, it ain't worth it. It costs too much money to fix that problem, so just keep them there. And so one day they tried to, and just in my situation, they tried to give me a drug that's commonly used for psychiatric problems, and they said, well, it also is used for back problems. So, and it was putting me to sleep and everything, and so I was like, no, I can't take this, man. As soon as I take it, I fall asleep. I don't need no sleeping drug. Medical, as you get older, is becoming a big problem. I've even read in even mainstream newspapers where they're saying that they need to start letting older prisoners out of jail because it just the medical cost is just too high. Not because of any certain form of humanity, just the medical cost is
basically in hopes that people will go on the outside and get jobs and pay for medical care or get on Medicaid or Medicare maybe?
Well, they're playing that game of hide and seek basically because, yeah, you go from Medicare, the prison system is, the prison medical system is covered by Medicaid anyway. So then you go out there, maybe you get on Medicare or vice versa. So you just move it from one to the other and I guess some numbers man for the politicians can play games with that.
So while on the subject of medication and to give listeners some sense of this, Mumia Abu-Jamal, former Black Panther, journalist, longtime prisoner in Pennsylvania, contracted Hep C from a blood transfusion just after being shot by the police and almost bleeding out in 1981 when he was arrested. He and his legal counsel brought a suit after he almost died in custody recently because of his Hep C and other ailments that are a product of his incarceration, and brought that suit against the PA system in order to get a cure for himself and other prisoners in that system. The judge just denied his suit, but it brings to light the fact that there is a cure for Hep C and other things that are caught often in relation to one's incarceration. Is Hep C a big thing at the Youngstown facility?
Not necessarily Youngstown, because a lot of the people are coming in and out of here from other places and coming here with it already. So this is really supposed to be a temporary jail anyway, so more people at other prisons in Ohio have it, but because I've seen and talked to some of them, I know that they've taken hepatitis medications or getting hepatitis treatment here. It was a lawsuit on this prison maybe 10 or 15 years ago about it because they were being denied it, and then they won the lawsuit, so they started treating it and treating it in a real aggressive form too. Some guys were really saved by the treatment, but it's a hard thing to even, because we don't have a right to know what's in our medical file. So you say you have a problem, and they.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
The prison people take your blood. They know exactly what they found. But if you don't know what you're looking for, then they don't have to tell you. So you may have hepatitis C or some other germ and not know you have it. And so you just carry it for years and years, and it creates all these other problems, and you always going to medical to deal with a symptom, to asking the doctors to help you deal with a symptom,
yeah,
without knowing the problem. Why the doctors then may know the problem but don't have to tell, because we don't have the right to access to our medical file. And I'm sure it's probably like that over there in Pennsylvania too. He didn't file the suit. I'm sure he know more about his situation.
You have 1 minute remaining.
Hey,
well, I should probably get going after this, I think.
Yeah.
Are there any last words you want to say?
Yeah, well, I would just like to say, you know, I hope that my main point of this bridge between prisoners and the activists that support us, we really need y'all, and we really appreciate y'all. And we need a stronger bond, I do believe. And anytime that you want to do another interview, just send me the email and I'll call right up. Freedom first to everybody.
Thanks a lot, Greg. It was great talking to you, and I look forward to talking again soon.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you for using GTL.
We've been speaking with Greg Curry, a prisoner serving time for alleged participation in the Lucasville prison uprising of 1993, where prisoners took over the Ohio prison, leading to the death of 10 inmates and one guard. More on Greg's case can be found at gregcurry.org. You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment, you are free to do so. Just send us an email so we know you're out there. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. Don't care if it's nutritious or FDA approved, it's gonna make me spaz like bobcats on booze. A hyperactive juice that only I can produce. If you use a giant drill, going straight into hell, releasing ancient demons from their sleep forever spell so they can walk.